SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, and hour two upon us on this Tuesday. We continue to take in the afterglow, the remainder of the Preakness weekend, and so many great images, and so many just really remarkable between the pictures of Justified leaping over the flying bridge that they use to get people in and out of the infield, the video of the fog and the way it enveloped the entire racetrack. It had a special atmosphere and a unique one, and so many people saying that they just can't recall anything really that similar. So really pretty special. And Jay Pribman of the DRF joins us, of course, and we wanted to get Jay's post Preakness take in proximity. And Jay, good morning.
Hey, Steve. Good morning. How are you?
Good. It's, you know, you get that, I don't have to tell you, the post intense period that Derby and Preakness and Breeders' Cup and Belmont, any time you come back from these kinds of events, you're a little logy.
Yeah, and I was in bed by 9 o'clock last night. I was pretty worn out, but it was certainly a fun week. It was a challenging week for everybody with all the weather that they had there. But you know, the one thing that, I mean, it was a great race, obviously, and an exciting race to watch. But I think the one thing, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, I think the one thing that really hasn't gotten as much attention as it should have is the unbelievable job the track superintendent that did keeping that track together. I mean, that track could have been lost without having somebody with knowledge and skill, because that was an absolute deluge for several days on end, and it was a safe track for racing on Friday and Saturday. And I just think that, you know, that needs to be, before we even go on and talk about the race, I wanted to get that out, because I don't think I've mentioned that enough in my post-race coverage.
Well, there's that mention, absolutely, and there's also something that I have got to mention, of course, and we can actually listen, because this really kind of says it all about Jay's work for Preakness.
Unbelievable. Where is he now?
He's already up to the Pimlico. Right, yeah. Then he's got the Junction, yeah, and the Avalon, the Garrison. That's the George's Deluxe in the corner.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what that is?
One, two, the whole left side of the menu. What a triumph if he pulls it off.
You're talking about 16 more if you include the Maryland fried chicken.
No, I think he's just talking dog sandwiches.
Excuse me, Earl. Does that include the fried chicken dinner?
Yes.
It does? Uh-huh.
22 deluxe sandwiches and the fried chicken dinner.
It's not human. He's not a person. He's like a building with feet. You know what I mean? It's unbelievable. Not going to pay you. No.
Stop. Oh, Earl! Oh, Earl is the king!
The whole left side.
The Portland. I didn't think
you'd
make Portland.
I did get it.
Earl, you want to look up something? You're locking up, man. Get him now or forget it.
Can he do it?
Yes, he's getting in the car!
Keep it.
Get breakfast, Earl. Keep trying to keep that down.
Stand the ovation for the Earl.
Standing O.
Standing O for the Priv, not for Earl. He did complete the left side of the menu in Diner, but standing O for Jay. who delivered Bravazo to a lot of people. And, Jay, they keyed off. I've got half a dozen emails and notes. So, standing O.
Well, it was to be accurate, it wasn't like I gave him Bravazo. I gave him it was a cold exacta.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like I picked Bravazo to win.
No.
But thank you for that. Yeah, no, it was a nice, it was a good result, and I was glad it flopped that way. Because I didn't think it was going to flop that way with an eighth of a mile to go. I didn't think Bravazo was going to get up for second. I thought Tenfold was going to be second at the furlong pole.
Well,
I'm glad he made his late surge there and got up.
Absolutely, and take us around, and the atmosphere, the way the day built, and really, I think people, it felt to me, everybody was treading water, literally, just waiting for this race, because the way the card got decimated with the off the turf, except for the Gallaret, and it was really just a matter of getting to the feature on Saturday.
Yeah, you ended up with races that were, you had like a three-year-old race on the grass and a three-year-old race on the main track that ended up being coming the same race twice. For instance, with those races rained off the turf, other than the Gallaret. But yeah, it was just a strange day, and it got even stranger when the fog rolled in like it did, and it was as thick as it had been all day for when the Preakness was running. I mean, from my vantage point on the press box level, I couldn't see the start of the race. Because the gate was obscured by fog. So I kind of watched the race similarly to what Larry Colmus did. There's a really great video of Larry up on that I've seen that NBC Sports posted with the camera that just follows. It's on Larry, and you could see the way that he had to call the race, which was a combination of TV and his own eyesight when he could actually see the horses. So it was just strange to watch the race on the big screen for me at the start of the race, and then see them come by the wire the first time. And then when they got to the clubhouse turn, they were gone again. And it was just basically watching the race on the big screen until they emerged again with about a furlong to go. It was just an exciting race. It was a fun race to write about as a journalist, just because the atmosphere was just so. I'd never covered anything like that. I've covered races where there's been lightning and rain, like when American Pharoah won at the Preakness, or just an absolute downpour, such as when Empire Maker beat Funnyside in the Belmont Stakes, or even the terrible weather at that Breeders' Cup at Monmouth Park, where it just rained all day long on Friday and most of Saturday. But I've never covered a big race where the fog rolled in and you couldn't even see basically three quarters of the race. So it made a fun story to write about, in addition to writing about a horse who's very, very special, who's now won all five of the starts and nobody'd even heard of a little more than 3 months ago, and here he's now heading to bid for a Triple Crown. It's a pretty amazing feat that Justify's accomplished.
No doubt, and we'll get to that and put that perspective together. Your view of the tactics, the way things unfolded. There's, of course, Chad Brown and Jose Ortiz, jumping off and feeling like he had made an error tactically, but drawing inside that more or less forced Good Magic's hand, and Chad and Jose Ortiz. Some thoughts about the shoulder-to-shoulder confrontation and the toll it took on Good Magic and what it says about Justify.
Well, we've seen that Justify could have a horse go with him early and still prevail in the Kentucky Derby with promises fulfilled, and then he had Boldoro make a run out of it, the 3/8, and Good Magic down the stretch, and he propelled all those bids. But this was different in that, Good Magic is obviously a lot better horse than Promises Fulfilled. And I know that after the race, both Jose Ortiz and Chad Brown said that wasn't their intent, was to do what happened. But I don't know why not, because if you don't do that, you're basically conceding the race to Justify, because nobody else looked like they wanted to take him on early. So by my way of looking at it, even if that was not even if that was an unintended situation, in the way the race would have unfolded otherwise, I do think it was his best chance to try and make something of the race. Because if he was going to sit second behind Justify and try and take him on, I mean, we already saw that movie 2 weeks earlier. And I just don't know that there would have been a different result, especially if Justify would have been allowed what would have been an uncontested early lead, had Good Magic taken back, let's say, and tried to get outside Justify, hypothetically, into the first turn. So I know they've said that that's not what they, that the way the race unfolded is not what they wanted to do, and I'm sure that's true. But in looking at the way it would have unfolded otherwise, I don't know that they'd have had a better chance of winning. So that's, I just think that the way it unfolded was probably, even if it was a happy accident, it was a better chance for Good Magic to try and win. It didn't work out, but I thought it gave him his best chance of trying to reverse the decision of 2 weeks earlier, Churchill Down.
I completely agree. And I guess the only thing that we wish we could include is having seen every step, but that's okay. At the Wire, Jay, with Tenfold and with Bravazo rallying and making some progress late, there's people who are using that as some evidence that this was somehow underwhelming performance-wise from the winner, and I just don't get it.
Well, I mean, it might not have been his best race. It might not have been as good as the Kentucky Derby, but I think a lot of times there's a real overreaction to results. I dare say that in the aftermath of the Kentucky Derby of 2015, there were probably a lot of people who thought that American Pharoah was going to be really vulnerable on the Triple Crown Trail after he had to gut out a victory that day over Firing Line in Dortmund. And all he did was just pulverize everybody in his next two starts. So I wouldn't get too far ahead of things just yet. I'm not saying Justify is going to win the Belmont Stakes, but I think there's this rush to judgment of like, oh, he can't win in 3 weeks, or he's a skill repeat of romps. They just said, oh, he can't lose. Well, you don't know that. You don't know how he's going to come out of the race, how he's going to train, who's going to run, what the pace of that race might end up being on paper. There's just so many variables still to come for the Belmont Stakes. I think people have gotten way ahead of themselves. And I actually put something up on Twitter on Sunday just saying, look, I don't know if the horse is going to win, and I'm perfectly willing to wait 2.5 weeks to make my pick. But keep in mind, this is a horse who's, you know, he's breaking the rules. He didn't run at 2 and won the Derby. Now he's also won the Preakness. No horse has ever done that. He's won 5 races since his debut on February 18. So in a little more than, basically 3 months' time, he's gone from an unstarted maiden to a 2-time classic winner. Plus, he also won the San Anita Derby. I mean, this horse is really, really good. And the other thing that I think is going to serve him well, Steve, in a quest for the Belmont Stakes, is his physical constitution. He's just a big, strong horse, and it's not like he's a small horse who's having all these races closer together would probably be more difficult for him. I'm going to be very interested to see how he trains, because we've seen he's set a level that I think we can look at in terms of how well he trains, and we'll see if he continues to train at that level. But I think people were getting way ahead of themselves after the race in terms of, he can't win the Belmont now, or things of that nature. I thought it was a gutty effort. I mean, as we were just discussing a moment ago, there's a lot different running head-and-head early with Good Magic than against Promises Fulfilled. So that cannot be discounted, that he put away a top-class horse like that and still hung on. And, yeah, it made it look closer because of Tenfold and Bravazo are on their best days. I don't think Tenfold and Bravazo are in the same area code as the best days of Good Magic and Justify, but just the way the race shape unfolded, I think, produced that kind of a result. And the pace of the Belmont's going to probably be different, you would think. But again, I think you need to look at it with a bigger picture. And so I'm certainly not, I'm not in the camp of either thing yet on Justify. I'm just willing to let things unfold. But I think what he's done to this point is pretty remarkable.
Well, and I kind of stressed that yesterday too. Baffert rounded out day one of the postscript here with us, and he, you can just tell he's as amazed as anybody. He took you, in fact, Jay, he took you, I don't know if you want, how much of this you want to discuss, but Bob Baffert took you into the stall and you know, was kind of talking and showing you, some things, to see him that close after the race and this on Sunday morning. You've covered Baffert for years now. Some thoughts on Baffert in this situation again.
Well, there's a few things about this. You know, first off, I mean, the morning that this horse made his debut, I had watched some workouts that morning in the box seat section. When it was over, I was just making small talk with him. I said, what about, your runners today? And he just looked me dead in the eye and he said, I've got some big plans for that colt this afternoon. I mean, that was the day Justify made his debut. So he already thought the morning of that horse's debut that he had tremendous potential. And we've seen how he was able to skillfully get him to the Derby and now through the Preakness. And I said this in another show recently, but I can't think of any other trainer in North America who would have had the foresight and the cojones to do what he did with this horse and to give him that chance to go from an unstarted maiden on Feb 18, not Jan 1, on Feb 18, and win the Kentucky Derby. And now to come back and win the Preakness. So here's a guy who's now won 5 Kentucky Derbies, right? Every one of his Derby winners has come back and won the Preakness. You look at some other trainers who have won the Derby and what their horses do in the Preakness. They bounce to the moon. This guy's horses win the Derby and come back 2 weeks later and win the Preakness. And in the case of American Pharoah, win the Belmont. In the cases of Real Quiet and Silver Charm, run excellent races in the Belmont and defeat. And the only one who laid an egg was War Emblem. And, I mean, he stumbled. I'm not saying he'd have won the race. I don't think he would have. But, I mean, he was eliminated at the start when he stumbled that day. But on the overall record of performance of his horses, to me, in the Triple Crown races, to win 5 Derbies and have all 5 of them come back and win the Preakness, there's nobody who's done that. And that just tells me, again, what a tremendous horseman he is. His horses are dead fit for the Derby, and they're ready to go when they come back in the, they can handle it in the Preakness. And how many Derby winners have we seen come back in the Preakness and just run horrible in recent years? Not his.
No. And it does speak to the fitness, and in fact, we talked about that leading in. You know, the 7 furlong works, the miles, the gallop outs, for another eighth or more, and that it just seems foreign. And you know, Jay, I don't remember, I think maybe it was after American Pharoah, or maybe it was after something with Arrogate or even West Coast with Travers. Why do other horsemen not take a clue from this? And obviously they can't necessarily do it Baffert's way, and they don't necessarily have their hands on the same kinds of horses. But why haven't, after this extended period of dominance by Baffert in the classic sequence, why are more horsemen not taking that clue?
You'd have to ask them. I mean, I don't know. All I know is, I've said this on your show before in regards to Baffert's approach to the Kentucky Derby. He trains to win the race, and there's a lot of people who train to just be in the race, and there's a difference. And it shows up most noticeably, I should say, to me, 2 weeks later, because they're ready for the Preakness, and they don't bounce to the moon. They haven't been treated like a hothouse flower coming into the race. And so they're able to withstand that 2-week turnaround and perform again. And that, you know, that's the difference. Why others don't do it, obviously you need the horse. I mean, you need a horse who can handle that kind of training. But I can't think that the only kinds of horses like that end up in his barn. So it's definitely a different approach. And, you know, maybe we'll see other people embrace that. And hopefully there'll be more trainers who get more chances. One thing you discussed, not in the context of the Triple Crown races, but just in general, is just how it just seems like just the same 5 or 6 trainers who get all the horses these days, and there's more than 5 or 6 good trainers out there.
Well, you also notice the kinds of pedigrees, the kinds of horses that Baffert, when he's involved with clients, that they pick out, and they're uniquely qualified to be prepared for classics and for the real route of ground type running, and he's been ahead of the curve on that front for a while. Not to say that there's anything wrong with buying middle distance pedigreed horses, but I mean he's picking out horses at sales that when it comes to the colts that he's projecting to spring of their 3-year-old year.
Well, that's true in terms of a lot of horses. With this horse specifically, though, this was not his pick. This was Elliot Walden.
Right.
So, but Elliot Walden, when deciding who gets which horses for Windstar, thought that this horse was best suited to be with Baffert. So it's sort of one step removed, but still, I think Elliot realized what you're alluding to in terms of who is best suited to handle a horse like this. This is going back now to the days of, Silver Charm and Real Quiet, who were not fashionably bred, expensive kind of horses. I mean, Silver Charm was an $80,000 2-year-old, and Real Quiet was, a $19,000 yearling? And, look what he did with them. I mean, there's a chicken and egg argument. I know now people are like, he just gets the best horses. Well, the reason he gets the best, or a lot of the best horses now, is because of what he did 20 years ago was not the best horses. People don't just get the best horses from the start. You have to show you're able to handle something. I mean, Chad Brown didn't get the best horses when he started out, but he produced, and look what he gets now. I mean, now he gets tremendous stock, but it wasn't like he was given tremendous stock when he first started out and had 11 horses. The first summer he was at Saratoga, but look where he is now because he produced. And Baffert has produced for a lot of years. I mean, now he's tied with Lucas for most Triple Crown race wins with 14, and he equaled the Preakness record of victories of 7 set by R.W. Walden, and that record was set back in the late 1800s when there was less competition in that race from all over the country. So it's pretty remarkable what we're seeing done here in this era. Some people are going to look back at 20 years from now and be like, wow, that was something else.
A couple of projections. Looking ahead to New York, and this morning, Jay, in the opening, I went back to colleague Dave Grenig's piece about the cross-referencing, you go to the catalog case to look at all the cross-ownership and its potential influence on the lineup in New York. You want to expand on how you think that affects things when we get to Belmont?
Yeah, there's a potential great effect here, and I think it's a little bit disturbing, to be honest. It's something that Dave and I have been talking about that we needed to do a follow-up on. And David talked to a couple people who were involved in those situations right around the time of the Preakness. And it was like, on Sunday morning, I was like, just go on with it, man. You've got the story. And it's a good one. Let's get it out there now. So specifically, there's Audible, whose ownership is the exact mirror of Justify. It's the exact same ownership group. And so you've got, what do? Do they run a horse who just finished third in the Kentucky Derby and has the classic Fletcher approach to the Belmont, the successful Fletcher approach to the Belmont, which is skip the Preakness and point for the Belmont. And Fletcher has just been on, you know, that's his MO, and it's in his wheelhouse. But is he going to get to put the bat, you know, is he going to be able to take a swing at the plate or not? I mean, it's a big decision. And, you know, I'm not sure they're going to do it. And then you've got my boy Jack, who has some overlapping ownership with because of Saul Kumin, who's an owner of Justify, and he's a part owner of my boy Jack. So you've got, you know, some of those situations. And to a lesser extent, Solomini, who doesn't have common ownership, but obviously Baffert trains him, and there was the potential for him to run. I'm not sure he'd be good enough, and I'm not sure he's looked at in the same level right now as the other two. But the overarching theme of all this is that because of all these partnerships, there's the potential, and especially here as we look towards the Belmont 2.5 weeks, the real potential for some horses who, if they'd been owned by different people or trained by different people, to absolutely be in the race. And there's a decent chance they won't be because of that. And that's a problem when you're talking about the beating the best. And I'm really torn over this. I mean, I understand the business aspect of why you wouldn't want to run a horse against your other horse who's going for the Triple Crown, but there's a big part of me that wishes some of these horses were with other people. And again, this comes back to what I was saying a few moments ago about all the horses being with 5 or 6 trainers. If they weren't all with 5 or 6 trainers, you might not be running into some of these issues. And I hope more people, I don't know, it's a real issue. It's a real, I struggle with this whole thing. Cause I mean, you can't tell people how to manage their horses. It's an investment and they need to do what's best. But boy, I dare say that if Audible was not owned by the same partnership, there's no question he'd be in the Belmont Stakes. And here we are wondering if they're going to go or not. And the tea leaves so far are leaning towards no.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an important discussion. It'll certainly, you know, play out however it plays out the next, you know, the next 12, 13 days. But I brought it up with Elliot Walden after the Derby. We had the conversation midweek with him, and I said, isn't this not a healthy equation for the game? And you know, what's he going to say? I mean, to be honest, I didn't, you know, but it is something that has to be, you know, discussed and appreciated. I mean, and it isn't just the competition in the afternoons that it has potential to water down. It also is a problem on the sales side where, you know, okay, yeah, we understand spreading risk, but you know, there's fewer, if there's people like Vinnie Viola and Mike Rapoli and people, you know, Stone Street and Bob Edwards. I mean, if owners of this ilk are banding together, Jay, to go in on the top sellers, it just means that there's less, you know, horses being purchased at what would be top dollar. And so that, you know, that's that issue we're seeing on the top end of sales, and we've been waiting for the middle to strengthen, but it's not going to strengthen if there aren't purchases that are forced down. So this is a far-reaching issue.
Well, yeah, I'm certainly more familiar with the whole racing side of it. I mean, the sales side of it, I'm less sympathetic to that, because I just think the prices of things in comparison to what you can race for on the racetrack are just so out of whack that, you know, I can understand wanting to try and mitigate risk in that standpoint. To me, it's the down the line, 2-3 years down the line after these horses are purchased, and now you end up in situations like this. Or even, I mean, in the case of Audible and Justify, I mean, they had similar ownership, you know, at the beginning of the year with just China Horse Club and Windstar. It was the other partners Starlight and Saul Kumin, who came in later on those horses. And if they don't come in, you know, there's no question why Boy Jack, for instance, would be in the Belmont Stakes, because there wouldn't be the overlap there. I mean, the Audible Justify overlap was going to be there regardless, because they both, I mean, they've been the same ownership for a while, and, you know, fortunately for that group, they both won Grade One final preps, Florida Derby and Santa Anita Derby, and deserved to run in the Kentucky Derby. And now they're faced with a really, you know, difficult decision. You basically run the horse who would probably be adjudged by most people to be the biggest threat to justify winning the Belmont and thus the Triple Crown. Do you tempt fate and run him against him? And you're dealing with an operation in Windstar that clearly is focused on making stallions, spotting horses to win Grade Ones, and, you know, they want their horses to be successful at the Grade One level, but they also want them to get a chance at stud fairly early on. And there's a lot to be weighed here on this decision, because Audible's already got a Grade One win. Doesn't have a classic win, but he's already got a Grade One win. But, you know, the other horse is going for immortality here. It's a challenging decision. I mean, you know, we can all sit on the sidelines and say, oh, it's, you know, the horse should run and it's not sporting and all that. And I'm certainly understanding of that element of it. And I wish, there's a part of me that wishes that horse was in different hands for this specific race, because, you know, he'd run and it'd be more fun to see him in there. But if you or I were in the same position, you know, I can't say that we, you know, I can't say I'd make a different decision from what Windstar is going to do.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
So
yep.
it's a real tricky thing to navigate.
Jay, a couple of different things, some odds and ends. Overall, this experience and the weekend, we saw another 2017 Derby participant. It's been a big weekend, a couple of weekends so far between Churchill and looking at Lee, and here was Irish War Cry winning the Pimlico Special. It seems like we've got a lot of Derby participants from a year ago that are around.
Right. I mean, we saw, for instance, McCracken win on Derby Day. It was 1 year too late for me, but he won on Derby Day this year, and he'll be going on to the Met Mile next for Ian Wilkes. So yeah, it's nice to see some of those horses come back and do well. I mean, Taprit is I think getting closer to a race. I mean, Always Dreaming just looks like he's not gotten back to his Derby form, and he's just, you know, I think it's just probably going to be a matter of time before they wave the white flag with him. But it is nice to see a lot of these other horses come back and do well and show that there is life after the Triple Crown.
Yeah. Any other interesting tidbits from the week?
No, I was just glad. Like I said, when we first came on with you, I was just really glad that they got through the day with the race going off well. And I just think the track superintendent at Pimlico deserves as much credit as anybody for the success of the weekend, because for those of us who were there, and just, I mean, after a while, it was like, it's still, you know, you get up in the morning, it's still raining. It's like, day after.
Yep.
Even Sunday morning when you got up, it was still drizzling. It was like, come on, enough already. You know?
Yep.
And of course, by Sunday afternoon, it was nice and it was warm. But it was an unforgettable Preakness. I'll tell you, with the atmosphere there, with the fog and everything, it was just, it was really a fun thing to write about, and hopefully we'll have a memorable Belmont Stakes and a competitive Belmont Stakes.
Exactly. Well, and then I did promise that I wasn't going to let you go without some of your hockey perspective and expertise with this. I mean, a truly incredible story that is not just developing but is already in place with this with this Vegas Knights. I mean, it's incredible.
Well, you couldn't have thought, you know, they'd come close to anything like this, obviously, at the beginning of the season. But I'll tell you what, if you watched them play a lot, which I did, you know, being that they're on the West Coast and I'd see a lot of their games and went to one of their games early on in the season, too. I went up there. You could tell, like, they're legitimately, you can see they're legitimately good. And, you know, I'm a big Kings fan, as you know, and my friend who I split my season seats with, when we drew Vegas in the first round, he's like, oh, you know, they've not been in the playoffs before. And I said, no, as a team they haven't been, but if you think James Neal and Marc-Andre Fleury and guys like that are going to wilt in a situation like this, and having watched the way these guys play, and the thing that they did that was smart when they drafted at the expansion draft is they drafted for speed, which is the way the game has changed, and their forecheck is just relentless, and that's what Winnipeg had so much trouble with, and that's what's going to be fun to watch, because they might not be, I mean, obviously they weren't the most skilled guys because they were, in a lot of cases, cast-offs. There were a couple situations of guys who the teams were like, oh, please take a two-for-one just to get this guy off of our books, and those guys have come back and haunted people. You know, guys like Marchessault and Tuck. And they're legitimately good, and they're fun to watch. And it's been, I have family that live up in Vegas. My sister and her family live up there. My mom lives up there, and you know, you have Rich Yang on. I mean, they'll tell you that the city's just gone nuts for this. And it's great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really neat to see what they've done, and I look forward to seeing who wins Game 7 in the East in a couple days and see who the finals are going to be. The funny thing is, you know, if Washington wins, Vegas will have home ice for the Stanley Cup finals. It's hilarious. It's like their first year, their expansion team, they have the potential to be the home team for the final round. If Tampa wins, Tampa's got home ice. But, I mean, that's just, to me, an incredible. So it's fun. You know, there's so many things about this that have been incredible, and that's just one other thing about it. So it's been fun to watch.
There was a, during the early portion of this most recent of the conference finals, I saw a graphic, Jay, that Vegas was the third team in NHL history, the third expansion franchise to win two playoff rounds. And in something you couldn't make up, it had come, the two prior had come in 50-year intervals, including the origins of the NHL, and then 50 years later, and now 50 years again. And it just, considering we were talking about justify overcoming, you know, the Apollo scenario into the 1880s and Baffert tying an 1880s era horseman in Walden. And here's a 100-year, you know, twice in a 100-year occurrence when it comes to the NHL. It's what makes sports so much fun.
Well, I don't want to go on too much more off the rails here. We're talking about hockey on your horse racing show, but you know, the 50 years ago one was the St. Louis Blues, and
right.
You know, by the way, the expansion then was designed, an expansion team had to get to the finals because the league went from 6 to 12 teams, and the new 6 teams, of which St. Louis was one of them, one of those teams was going to get to the finals, the way it was set up. So what Vegas has done is a completely different situation. It's not like they were in a division where, well, one of these new teams is guaranteed a spot in the Stanley
right.
Cup Finals, which is what happened with St. Louis 50 years ago. So I think when people start making that comparison of like, oh, you know, they're the first team since St. Louis to do this. Well, no, they're not. St. Louis didn't. St. Louis or whoever the other expansion teams then, which included the Kings, which is why I'm so familiar with the situation, because that's the same, you know, the Kings came into the league. I mean, one of those teams was going to get to the finals because they were guaranteed a spot in the finals. Vegas was far from guaranteed a spot in the finals.
Right.
So it's an incredible achievement.
Yeah, and the same thing, I sort of am massaging this in because Justify is doing something that is just unprecedented, and people should remember that as it proceeds.
Yep, no, he is. It's what he's done is remarkable. Unprecedented is the word. That's for sure.
Jay Privman, unprecedented coverage of the Triple Crown and more.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Jay Privman,
see you
folks.
Those week.
There you go. Is there? Has Vegas posted a number?
No, it's going to be lower than usual because I've already got some obligations, but I'll do my best. I think the over-under is going to be about 4.5.
Ooh, I'm going to take the over. That there'll be a couple of sneak overs for quick hits, I think. That's what we're counting on. Jay Privman at King Umberto's, everybody. It's one of the great bets of the spring. We'll take a break right here. We'll come back and talk about betting at Erie, Pennsylvania, Presque Isle Downs, and week one is off and running. And yesterday, the Tom Ridge Stakes, they snuck the Tom Ridge in yesterday. We'll talk about Dick Powell's view of Preakness as well. It is take leading into Belmont. Dick joins us after this. A little John White recapping after that. Jeremy Plunk, countdown to the crown. And now it is. It's countdown to the crown again. Look at the fascinating history going back, into the 30s. Gallon Fox and three in the 30s, four in the 40s, three in the 70s, and one here in the teens. I guess he has to win. Because we can't close out the decade. There can't be a decade with just one Triple Crown winner. There has to be multiple Triple Crown winners. Because there's always been. 1919, I guess, stands alone. But Sir Barton didn't even know he was winning a Triple Crown. Neither did Mr. Ross, Commander Ross. Back after this.
Latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
With 35 years at the forefront of sports technology, Stats provides next-generation sports content for basketball, baseball, football, soccer. And now, Stats is turning its sights to horse racing. RaceLens is the most in-depth product on the market. With innovative analytics powered by data from Equibase, it will change the way you follow horse racing. Stats RaceLens, bringing clarity to handicapping. Learn more at stats.com/RaceLens.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the 5 Kentucky Tracks for Horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.